This is NPR on Health. I'm Joe Neal. With the Tour de France in its final stages and the Olympics a couple of weeks away, we thought we'd take a look at doping and the efforts to try to catch athletes who are cheating. And while we're in the lab, we'll also hear a story about how scientists think they found a way to better predict the success of in vitro fertilization. As the Tour de France entered its final week, more bicyclists were kicked out for failing drug tests. And if history is any guide, there will be more of the same as the Olympics start to get ramped up in the next couple of weeks. Sometimes it seems like there's as much competition between the athletes and the laboratories as there is on the field. NPR's John Hamilton reports that while doping tests have come a long way in recent years, the dopers always seem a few steps ahead.
The International Olympic Committee plans to conduct 4,500 doping tests in Beijing, the most ever. And John Fahey, who runs the World Anti-Doping Agency, even put out a video to declare his confidence in those tests.
If the cheats turn up, I am satisfied that they are more likely to be caught at these Olympics than in any other Olympics in its history.
But Fahey stopped short of saying the games will be clean, or even that most of the cheaters will be caught. Charles Yeselis of Penn State University has spent decades studying doping in sport. He points out that just a few years ago, testing failed to catch several U.S. track stars, including Marion Jones and Tim Montgomery.
The cream of the crop of the best track team in the world were dirty, and between them, they passed hundreds of drug tests.
They were caught several years later when their names turned up during a criminal investigation into Balco, a lab that supplied designer steroids to elite athletes. You can test for designer drugs, says John Daniso from the University of Utah, but only if you know what you're looking for.
If somebody comes up with a completely novel drug that, you know, we don't know to look for it, yeah, it's possible that we can miss it.
Another problem is that dopers are using synthetic versions of stuff the body already makes, like human growth hormone, or EPO, which boosts red blood cells. Even sophisticated tests can't always tell the difference. Also, there are so many new drugs that it's hard for testers to keep up. Yeselis says these drugs are intended for people with deadly diseases like cancer or muscular dystrophy.
But there are these unethical medical scientists that are sitting up in the trees like vultures ready to pounce on them for their use in athletics. And some of these drugs work well.
Looking ahead, even knowing what drugs to test for won't be enough. Future dopers are likely to try gene doping, which will be almost impossible to detect. Lee Sweeney from the University of Pennsylvania is working with a gene that can be injected into a muscle and make that muscle larger. It works on rodents and dogs, and Sweeney's getting lots of queries from athletes. He says a typical pitch goes like this.
I've read about your work. I understand it's not yet in people, but I really would like to try it, and maybe that would help further your work. That's the sort of spiel I get.
He turns these people away, and he doubts athletes know enough to try gene doping on their own. But Sweeney gets why would-be dopers are so intrigued by his approach.
It affects only the muscles that you inject, and so there's nothing in the blood to detect in those cases. And so in those, you know, if we were able to perfect that sort of delivery in humans, then there would be nothing in the blood or the urine for WADA to test for.
They would actually have to remove part of the muscle and test that. Doping experts say better tests are catching people who wouldn't have been caught just a few years ago. But that's not going to get rid of the cheaters.
The Olympics and the power and the money behind it is just too big.
Don Catlin runs a company called Anti-Doping Research. He says elite athletes simply have more money than the World Anti-Doping Agency or its U.S. counterpart.
WADA has a budget of 23 or 24 million. USADA has 2 or 2.5. When you're up against a problem of this nature and magnitude, those amounts of money just can't do it.
Catlin says there will be clean athletes who win their events in Beijing. There's just no way to tell who they are. John Hamilton, NPR News.
More on doping now. NPR's Mike Pesca recently spoke with an expert about some of the newest methods athletes are using to game the system. The interview aired on the NPR program Bryant Park Project.
We all know about EPO, steroids and all that, but what else is out there and what's on the horizon? As the Peloton makes its way through France and as the Beijing Games are less than a month away, we thought we'd call up Larry Bowers of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, or USADA, to hear the methods our future would-be heroes will be using to later disappoint us. So, how are you doing, Larry?
I'm doing fine.
USADA tests for every sport?
We test Olympic sport.
Yeah,
so,
in every Olympic event.
Correct.
Is there any event that's never had a drug problem?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's ever been a positive drug test in a number of sports, and I'm, you know, curling comes to mind.
Curling, right. That's winter.
So I'm not aware of them ever having a positive drug test, so they may not have a problem.
Table tennis, you test for the table tennis guys?
We've tested table tennis, and there have been a few positives.
Really? What advantage can be gained? Just quickness, training?
Probably.
Yeah. What is the biggest thing you are worried about?
Well, I still think that there are a lot of things about oxygen transport or getting oxygen to your muscles and then how your muscles use it. You touched on EPO.
Mm-hmm.
The pharmaceutical industry is now working on a number of compounds that work like EPO, but they're not actually EPO. So that's going to provide us with a challenge in the future for a number of those compounds and trying to detect those.
Now, when you say the pharmaceutical industry, these will be legal, just misused if someone tries to use them in the athletic endeavors?
Absolutely. A lot of the drugs that we're talking about have legitimate medical purposes and used appropriately help people. But when they're abused, it becomes a different issue for sport.
There's this new thing that people are talking about called mitochondrial manipulation. Explain how might that help an athlete?
There is a compound that people are very interested in that comes from wet red wine that makes the mitochondria change from making heat for your body to making more energy. So again, we've got an eye to those kinds of things to make sure that as these compounds are developed into drugs that we don't have people artificially enhancing their performance.
Now, I don't know about USADA, but I know that WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, is looking into Viagra as a performance enhancer, and we mean a performance enhancer in the arena, not afterwards. What do you know about how that would work?
There was about a year or so ago, there was some information that in dog racing, people were using Viagra to enhance the performance of dogs successfully. There are very few studies in humans, but the one study that has been done shows that Viagra can help performance, but only when you're at high altitude. So, again, something we have an eye on, but at this point it's not at all proven that it would help an athlete.
I've also read something about, this seemed like almost cartoons and mutants and X-Men, but there are some people who are genetically predisposed to beat drug tests. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
There are a population of people who metabolize testosterone differently than the majority of people.
Mm-hmm.
And this information has been known in the Olympic drug testing community for probably since the mid-90s.
Mm.
There's a small group of people, probably less than 10% in Caucasians, in Asians, much higher probability of this gene being missing, that metabolizes testosterone in the normal way, and therefore they have very low TE ratios. The way the anti-doping community is working on combating that is to use each individual as their own reference point.
Their own baseline.
You've got it.
Right, so it doesn't matter if testosterone spikes above a predetermined threshold that exists for the whole population. You just test it against the individual's pre-existing threshold.
That's exactly right. We're looking at the individual threshold, and as we go to the future, that'll be our point for instituting a doping violation.
There are some of them you could buy over the internet. Probably top athletes wouldn't be so unsophisticated as using something called a Wizinator and other devices that are used to either give someone else's urine into the specimen cup.
Right.
So aside from the actual drug testing that you do, do you do any testing to try to root those out?
Yeah, we use one of the things that's done for Olympic sport is we do full observation of the urine passing from the person into the cup, and the reason we do that is to make sure that that we don't have people using things like Wizinators.
Now, let me do this delicately. A Wizinator is a device that you strap to maybe your inner thigh, and it makes it appear as if urine is coming out of your anatomy, but it's fake. It's a fake piece of anatomy. Is that basically how it works?
Absolutely, and not only that, but it the device has a little heater in it so that the urine comes out at body temperature.
Ah, yes, so, and I know they're also sold in different skin tones.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any? I mean, come on, the guys in the office say, could you believe that this guy tried to get away with this? So what's the this in that sentence?
There actually was a device that some of the Eastern Europeans were caught with at the Athens Olympics that is known fondly in the industry as a butt wedge. And basically what it is a bag of urine that's inserted into your anatomy and a tube run taped between your legs in an attempt to pass that off as your own urine.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the ones that we've all thought about and thought what a crazy world this is when we get to that point.
And the butt wedge was not the perfect crime. They got tripped up on the butt wedge, did they?
They got caught by the observation process. Yep.
Larry Bowers is senior managing director with USADA. Thanks very much, Larry.
You bet.
More about test tubes now, the kind used for in vitro fertilization. The first so-called test tube baby was born a little over 30 years ago, but the procedure still hasn't been perfected. Many couples undergo IVF multiple times before conceiving, and some never do. Now, as NPR's Joe Palca reports, a team of researchers at Stanford University is developing a method for predicting when IVF will be successful.
Many factors can affect whether a particular cycle of IVF will result in a baby. One of the most reliable is age. The younger the parents, the more likely they'll have a child. But even younger parents can fail to have a baby on their first attempt at IVF, and then they face a difficult decision. Do they try again with the procedure, go through the stress, the expense, the inconvenience, the drugs, the discomfort, or do they quit and look into other ways of building a family? Milen Yao is a fertility specialist at Stanford University School of Medicine. She says it would be great if there were a way to give patients more specific predictions about their personal chances of getting pregnant.
If they are told that you have very high chance of taking home a baby at the end of this, that is much more powerful and much more informative than telling someone, well, based on your age, this is what you might expect.
So Yao and her colleagues are trying to find ways to predict the outcome of IVF. To start, they went into their medical records and looked back at all the patients who came through the Stanford Fertility Clinic in 2005. They looked at 30 different factors, including age, number of embryos a couple produced, and the reason for their infertility. Then, Yao and her colleagues used statistics to see which factors were most likely to predict whether a particular IVF cycle would result in a pregnancy.
It turned out that you can use four factors, and those four factors alone gave prediction at 70% accuracy.
The four factors were the amount of follicle-stimulating hormone the woman produced, as well as the total number of embryos, the number of embryos that had grown to 8 cells by day 3, and the number that had stopped growing by day 3. The work is published in the journal PLOS ONE. Mark Hornstein is director of the Center for Reproductive Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He says he's particularly impressed that Yao found you have to look at all of a couple's embryos, not just the one or two you transfer to her uterus in predicting outcomes.
They note correctly, and we've made this observation in our own program, that the prognosis for pregnancy doesn't depend only on the embryo that's implanted. It depends also on the entire group of embryos.
And Hornstein agrees it will be valuable to know what factors predict the outcome of IVF. But he says the Stanford study only looked at whether or not an IVF cycle resulted in a pregnancy.
And when we assess prognosis for a couple, we always talk about take-home baby.
Because that's what couples who go through IVF really want. Stanford's Milan Yao says the study being published this week is just the first phase of her work. She's working on a bigger study now that will look at take-home babies. She says for now her work is research. She hopes it will lead to something that can be used routinely for advising patients.
We are not at that point yet, but I hope that will be in the near future.
Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
We go back now to the Bryant Park Project and NPR's Mike Pesca for a look at an offshoot of IVF, surrogate pregnancy.
Military wives are often determined and selfless, and because they are military wives, they usually could use a little extra income. That is a formula that makes them perfect candidates to be surrogate mothers. According to a recent Newsweek article, military spouses currently make up about 50% of the carriers at in vitro fertilization clinics and surrogacy agencies in Texas and California. The economics of this arrangement play a key role. The military's health care plan covers a mom who's carrying someone else's child. A lot of health care plans don't. Angel is a military wife who was recently matched with a couple for surrogacy, and she joins us now. Hello, Angel.
Hello.
And also with us is Stephanie Caballero, founder of Extraordinary Conceptions, I get it, an egg donation and surrogacy agency in San Diego. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello.
Angel, tell me a little bit about yourself. From what I understand, you have many, many children's.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen to me. Children. And your husband is currently deployed in Iraq with the Navy, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. So why was now, with everything you got going on, why was now a time to take on having another child?
Well, it's not my child. I'm having it for somebody else. And it wouldn't be me raising the child.
Sure. But being pregnant, doesn't that slow you down? You have a lot to do with those six kids.
Well, with six kids, another pregnancy really isn't a big deal, I guess you could say.
I guess you could say as a percentage, it's just a drop in the bucket.
It's just something that happens. It's not something that will slow me down. Obviously, I'm used to being pregnant, so with six of my own kids, then being older, it makes things easier.
How old's your youngest?
He's 18 months.
Oh, okay. And how far along are you in this pregnancy?
I'm not pregnant yet.
Oh, you're going to be.
No.
And who do you think will help you with the kids and everything else you have to do once you become pregnant, once you're, really 8 months along and so forth?
Well, I have a great support system with plenty of friends. Some are military, some are not. Majority are. And I have my family, and my husband hopefully will be back at the end of the year. So if by chance I'm pregnant, then he'll be here towards the end.
What are his feelings about this decision?
Oh, he's very supportive.
And what kind of money are you looking at, do you think?
I really don't want to go into the financial because it's not about financial.
So what's it about?
For me.
What's your motivation?
It's about helping a family. That's why I went into this, to help another family. I've been blessed with six children. These people just want one. They'll be lucky with to have twins, but it's more or less helping somebody else out that can't do it.
Stephanie, you're there in San Diego, huge military town. How many of the surrogates that your agency works with are military wives?
Currently, we have about six military wives of the 15 active cycles.
Okay, so that's, more than a third of all your wives who are pregnant or women who are pregnant are military wives.
Correct.
What makes them good for this sort of role?
They're very stable and... Not that I want to discount our non-military surrogates,
mm-hmm.
but they don't complain. You tell them that they're going to be taking, injectable medication, and some of the needles are very large for 3 months, and they're like, fine, that's fine.
Was it always the case that people in your line of work knew that military wives were, fertile ground, if you will, for surrogacy, or recently has there been an uptick in that?
We always knew it. I think the media has recently grabbed onto this story.
Yeah, I'm guilty as part of that. And so tell me a little bit about the money at stake. You don't have to talk about Angel specifically, but if I was a wife, a military wife or otherwise, a military wife, because healthcare might come into it, and I came into your office, I'm like, pitch me on this. I'm willing to go through it. What would you tell me could be waiting for me at the end?
I have to say Angel's right. Most women don't ask about the money first, and if they do, we don't accept them
mm-hmm.
Because you can't be pregnant for somebody just for the money because you're pregnant 24/7. So it's not like a 9-to-5 job where you can, at 5 p.m. say, my day is done and I'm not going to be pregnant for you. But most women who are surrogates earn about throughout the whole entire pregnancy, so it's about a year, earn about $25,000.
$25,000. Now, the San Diego Tribune reports that the military's main medical provider, which is called TRICARE,
correct,
is one of the few health care insurers nationwide that doesn't ban coverage for surrogate pregnancies. So if you use a woman with TRICARE benefits, the intended parents avoid paying. How much do they usually pay for standard surrogacy medical policy? How much do they usually wind up paying?
It all depends, because a lot of insurers have, you know, either an exclusion or they want the intended parents to pay up to $10,000. TRICARE does have something called cost sharing,
mm-hmm,
so they can ask for the intended parents to pay the benefits. Most people don't know that, but they've had it since, I think, 1994.
So that means, but TRICARE has to know about where the pregnancy comes from? I mean,
yes.
How does it work in the real world?
Yes, and surrogate mothers who are military wives do not hide it. They absolutely, that goes against their nature and what their husbands believe in as being part of the military. So they are absolutely forthcoming and always happen with the pregnancy.
And so is it just random whether TRICARE finds out about it, or, you know, sometimes they pay for the surrogate mom's pregnancy and sometimes they don't?
I used to work in the insurance field.
Yeah.
It's when a surrogate mother goes out of network.
Okay.
Because then obviously, you know, a TRICARE has to pay a higher portion, and they could go through the file and then they see that it's a surrogacy. So I think that's when they ask for, you know, the payment.
And so if I come into your office as intended parents, is that the phrase you use?
Correct.
Okay, so if I'm an intended parent, do I say, well, we'd like a military wife, that'll be, you know, less costly for us, we can't be picky? Or is the cost for the intended parents always the same?
No, but some intended parents have a budget more than others, and so they request a surrogate with insurance. They don't normally request a surrogate with military, you know, military wives, but I think they're not requesting it because we have, you know, we always have two or three military wives that are new surrogates that are pregnant. I'm not pregnant, but that are new. So they're not specifically asking for it. They're asking for insurance in general.
Right.
And other insurance carriers do cover surrogacy.
Do you let your intended parents, if they can, make requests, military wife, non-military wife?
Oh, yes.
Really?
I've had intended parents come and say, I'd like a military wife.
And you say to them, we'll see what we could do, or do you say that's not your decision?
Well, no, they actually will let them know who's military, and then they'll look at their profiles and see who they click with, and then they'll have a meeting with them to see further if they want to continue.
Angel, how'd you first hear about this possibility at all?
About being a surrogate?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I wanted to do it for about 10 years now. And since my husband and myself were done having our children, we figured this is the perfect time.
Do you know anyone else there? I don't know if you live on base, but do you know anyone else within the community of military wives who've done it?
Yeah, I met women that have done it. I have a friend that's going through the process as well. I started the process. Then once I told her everything was fine, she was worried about the shots, and I told her it was okay. They hurt, but, you know, you deal with it.
Yeah.
And she started the process as well.
There's good word of mouth in the community on this
yeah,
whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you think that you're done having your own children?
Oh, yes, we're done.
Okay. And so you can
I think is plenty.
What kind of counseling, I guess, Stephanie, you can answer this best. What kind of counseling do you do about, you know, the psychological aspects? There might even be postpartum depression that sometimes happens after a baby. So what do you talk to the wives about that?
Well, we have a case manager that stays really in touch with the surrogates throughout the whole entire pregnancy. So she's there to help them. And if they have any problems like that, we have somebody that we work with very closely. We have actually two psychologists, and they can talk to that psychologist at any time during the pregnancy as well as afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had anybody experience postpartum. But there is always a little bit of a letdown, so we just help the intended parents stay really close in touch. The surrogate needs to say goodbye to the baby and you know, welcome and goodbye and have a, you know, great life with your parents. But that needs to happen, and if that happens, so usually the end is better. It's when the intended parents, for whatever reason, you know, take the baby and walk off and never speak to the surrogate again. That's where, you know, the surrogate has a tough time.
Yeah. And how about screening? How many, you know, what percentage of people who have an interest in this actually do you allow to go through with it?
I would say it's probably 60%. We screen out 40% of the surrogates. You'd be amazed at what they say during the interview process.
And I'm sure for health, there's some screening that has to occur.
Because, you know, you can be pregnant for yourself, and you can assume that risk for yourself. But let's say you've taken Fen-Phen before. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can be pregnant for yourself. But, you know, intended parents don't want to take the risk that you've damaged your heart, and you could have a heart attack while you're pregnant.
What's the upper age limit of a woman who wants to be a surrogate?
It's 40, but usually, if you're 39, it's going to be tough for an intended parent to pick you.
Yeah.
35 and under is the best age range.
All right. Angel, who is the wife of a Navy serviceman, she intends to become a surrogate mom, and Stephanie Caballero, who runs Extraordinary Conceptions. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this podcast. There's more on health at our website, npr.org. Just click on the link over on the left side of the page. If you want to hear even more health stories on the radio, there's a list of your local public radio stations on our website. Just click on the Stations button at the top of the page. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.